I think for me, the role of a sommelier is to create a wine list which is relevant to the food that is being served. It's not just about a sommelier's wet dream or what they want to have, yeah, or looking after their mates. And I see it time and time again, and it annoys the crap out of me.
Welcome to the Hospitality Podcast.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Come on, man.
I just need it.
This is the lamb.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Presented by Arthur Gomez.
God damn, I just spent $8,000 on some f***ing wine.
And Quentin Wind.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So pour yourself a glass, because we're diving into the world of restaurants, kitchen and bar. The Hospitality Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome.
Welcome to Waking the Cork. Today, a new episode of the podcast with a special guest as usual, but not a new guest.
Not a new guest, yeah, actually.
We have Victoria Sharples with us today.
And it's been, 2 months from the last one?
Yeah.
I think a bit less than that.
Less?
It was 2 months.
When you say old guest, does that mean it's because of my age?
No. No, I didn't say old. I said it's not a new guest.
Sorry, yeah, not new. I just assumed old. My bad.
Yeah. We had such a good time the first episode that we thought, you know what, let's get back in touch with Victoria and invite her for a second one. She's up for it. Here she is, and she brought some goodies with her, actually.
Ooh. I like to BYO where I can. Exactly. In the Aussie culture.
Yeah. We did put a BYO charge, so I think we charge you, £50 per bottle?
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. That's some reason for London.
For champagne in particular.
There you go. Talking about champagne, do you want to introduce you what you brought?
I will. This is a champagne that is close to my heart. I used to import this to Australia a long time ago. It reached the UK subsequently. Small grower champagne now. Mm. So there were Geraldine Lacourte inherited. She was using the cooperative to make the wine, but doing it in a separate batch. And now they are a récoltant manipulant.
Even for French,
oh my god. But they make it on site now, so they have their own winery and everything is on site.
Okay.
And it is, in the most difficult word I can think of in French aside from millefeuille, it's
millefeuille. I love that. Do you want to show the bottle at the camera?
Oh, I will. It's a okay. As we like to say, okay. Okay?
Okay.
So, and I will open it. So this has been my cellar for a little while. I did not bring it across from France, but
Can't wait to try it.
Wouldn't be the first time. It is, I thought it was just the right thing to do, being Christmas festive.
It is.
That we should drink champagne.
Exactly. We have the Christmas decoration in the studio.
I did notice they're looking very Christmassy, yeah. Even if it's not quite the 1st of December.
No.
Should I do my 101 of opening a bottle of champagne while
yes,
I'm here?
Yes, show how you should, oh, actually. Yeah. It's
how
a very
should.
Good.
Now, I could have the label showing, but I'm not going to bother. But it's take the foil off first. Never, ever take the cage off. Always leave it on. I think it's more like 6 twists. And we can hold the bottle, keep your thumb on top of the cork and the cage. Twist the bottle, not the cork. Otherwise, you can break the cork. How appropriate. And hopefully it's a bit buoyant. So I just control it. Done.
Beautiful.
Voila.
Nice.
Magnifique.
So that way, because you've got equivalent of tire pressure,
yeah,
in a bottle of champagne. And if you take the cage off, there's every chance, if it's been shaken up a bit, it could pop off and you have no control.
Yeah.
So it's always about keeping control. We don't need the big pop. We're not at the car races.
A question.
Yeah,
for
please.
A lot of people, maybe they don't really know. Even in the industry, I feel like nobody really knows. When you pour beer, champagne, the glass is for champagne. It has to be straight. It has to be a bit.
No, I like you've asked me this question.
I want to show actually how to pour a good champagne.
Oh, okay. Now I've got a lot of what's the things in my way here?
Oh,
microphone.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me just move a couple of things. Okay. So for me, and you may notice a glass, and that can be a topic of conversation, I never tilt the glass. So if you're serving in a restaurant, and when I first started out, we were taught to pour beer without having to tilt the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to pour it just so it hits neatly on the side, slowly. So you've always got control. And I could keep going. I could fill the glass, but I won't. that's a story. That's another story.
Nice.
There we are.
And then you can enjoy your champagne.
If you pour too quickly,
yeah,
you've got to then wait. So the idea, ideally, you want to be able to pour in one pour.
One go.
Mm.
Exactly, in one go. So you have to do it quite slowly. If you do it too quickly, you get too much head, too much froth, too much mousse.
Mm. Apparently, this thing is better because you keep more bubbles and it's better for digestion.
Yeah. So I like the glasses I brought with me today.
They are really nice. I love these glasses. I'm just saying, but...
I love these glasses. I like them so much, I bought 5 pallets of them.
5 pallets?
Yeah, I don't make them anymore.
I thought you were saying 5 glasses. But
yeah, no, I actually I bought a lot. When I had my restaurant, I was like, God damn, I've got to get these. And we'll break a few, but I thought I'd have more just up my sleeve. I may still have some available. But so two points. One is, for me, a coupe is a waste of time. It's all for show and not much else. A straight-sided or a flute. There are some flutes which are more like a wine glass, which are much better for the wine. I mean, champagne is a wine. And as it ages, it becomes more and more like it's still wine. It's just... Mm. Mm. You know, it loses its bead.
Yeah.
And when I'm judging in a competition as well, I will never judge with a flute. I'll always use a more standard wine glass because you can swirl and you can get the aromas.
Of course.
If it's just straight up and down, you get no nose. You know, sort of.
That's true.
It's just.
Yeah. And what do you think of the coupette?
The coupe?
The large one, yeah.
Bloody waste of time. Mm. Oh, did I say that?
Fancy, though.
Oh, it's very fancy, but I just... Look, it's awkward to hold. It's easy to spill.
Yeah.
And you can't swirl it. Yeah. I'm a natural swirler.
Yeah.
But also, it evaporates... What does it evaporate? The bead will go much faster. So you've got a much greater surface area.
Mm.
And also in a flute, the way they normally... If you look... I know some of the manufacturers will have... A rough bottom, which will help promote the bead. That's why you never want to have soap in glasses because that'll also take away the bead.
Of course.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Actually,
And do you think Richard is allowed a glass?
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, we have a guest with us. Another guest.
A background guest.
Off screen.
I feel like he's quite thirsty.
He's always thirsty.
Go for it.
Yeah.
La Côte Gobillon, Premier Cru.
Yeah.
Champagne from Acueil. Which is just in the Montagne de Reims.
Mm.
Just Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, no Pinot Meunier.
Yeah.
And this would have been dated when it was disgorged. The dosage is, I don't have my glasses on, so you can tell me. It's not hugely high in dosage. Where are my eyes? Thank you.
3.5.
I mean, there's always that magic number of dosage on Brut, about 8 grams, somewhere between 6 and 8. But I think this is lovely as a...
Yeah.
Everyday drinker.
20 months on the lees.
Yeah, it has quite a lot of time on lees and elegant.
So is it true that the bigger the bubbles are, the worse the champagne is?
Not necessarily. Okay. The bubble will become smaller over time. So it's normally an indication of time in bottle.
Okay.
So the longer it's in bottle, if you leave it in there long enough, it'll become a still wine. And I think that's something that people often forget or they don't realise, that if you order a vintage champagne from somewhere in the mid-80s or the 70s or prior to that, and one, the colour will be much more golden, but also it'll look much more like a still wine. The bubble will be gone. Mm. It will be flat. And when someone's going, I've just won the lottery and I've got my 1960-something or other, whichever champagne it may be, and it's really golden in colour and flat. I think just because a wine is expensive doesn't mean it's good.
It's good. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's another subject, actually.
It is another subject. There's so many. But I think, you know, for me, if I'm looking for a champagne, it's really easy, and I think this becomes an issue at times where you'll know all the grand marques, and often, especially when they are available in the high street, people still are willing to buy in a restaurant.
Of course.
And normally you will never pay the same markup. So actually, champagne on a restaurant wine list is normally really good value compared to all the other wines.
Mm.
Just because they're, we tend not to put that markup on. It's sort of a tricky issue in some ways, champagne. Because it is often, yes, it's seen as a luxury. It automatically says celebration, definitely says Christmas, birthday, any kind of New Year. Yeah. Even more. And I think it's I'd always start with the better champagne first and then go down. As you drink through the night or the day, you want to start with the good stuff because that's what you remember.
Yeah, of course. But that's the number one rule, actually, because so many people actually do it the other side.
And like, you're getting drunk, so you're like, let me open this.
Oh, open this one. Oh, it'll be amazing.
And the next day, the Romane Conti 45, gone.
I've got quite a good story that I'll tell after about a night like that. But I will let you finish first.
Oh, I think I finished.
Oh, okay.
I've lost track.
Sorry.
Let me drink more champagne.
One evening I got invited by this client of my wine shop, and he said, come home. I'm having dinner. I'm inviting this and that at home. Whoever can come. I'm moving to the States, so I've got my wine cellar that we need to drink up, basically. I thought nothing more than okay. He probably has maybe a few wines. And we arrive at his. I bring a bottle, take it from my hands, so I just put it on the side somewhere. So we start aperitif, bam, one bottle, two bottles. There was about eight of us. Continue. So, 2 hours later, I think everyone is starting to be quite tipsy, and it's like, Quentin. It's like, do you want to go in the cave and choose whatever bottle you want? I was like, okay.
Fair risk.
Whatever bottle.
Oof. And I go into the cave, which was like, in London, it's literally a one room. one bedroom. So.
It's a one bedroom flat.
It's literally one bedroom full of wine. I was like, oh, wow, okay. So this guy is actually serious. And especially, it's serious when you see a lot of dust around the bottle and you can't really see the label anymore. So I was like, okay, let me go for the dustiest bottle and see what's under there. And at that point, I couldn't even remember what I was looking at. So I just went for...
The dustiest.
No, dustiest, but also the date, the oldest.
Okay.
Because why not?
What's vintage?
I can't remember. Ah. It's that kind of night. And
hence, you should try and get into that room first before...
Exactly.
At the end of the night.
I had no clue he had those kind of bottles, so I didn't even bother. Yeah, I think it was like a 1940 something, and I was like, okay, let's try that. It might be gone because it's not a proper cellar, first of all. Two, I don't know if he's moved the bottles a little bit. Anyways, we take this one and it's like, do you have a decanter? And he goes, no, my wife broke it last week. I said, how are we gonna decant it? Get a salad bowl. So we opened it, put it in a salad bowl. Let it breathe for like 10-15 minutes.
Oh my god.
And then I was like, how are we going to serve this? Here's a ladle. We took the ladle and started, pouring wine into the glasses.
How many hours was this into drinking? I mean, this is creative.
I know, but it was, at the same time, you're like, oh my god, this can't be real. You can't not have a decanter at this point. And so we're in that situation where we put really good wines and old wines. Actually, that one wasn't that great. I think it went a bit off. It was a bit past its time.
And I would expect, and I was actually at a preview of a really interesting auction a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there were some wines that we were able to try. Some came from south of France. There's extraordinary wines, some of which definitely had not had a loving life. Others were still exquisite. There was a Madeira from the mid-1800s, which was unbelievable.
Oh, God.
It was just extraordinary. The label had come off. They didn't know the whole history to it, but oh, my God, it was delicious. But then there are others, and they get that real mushroom. And mushroom is quite normal, as you were talking about age champagnes. You'll get this sort of mushroomy, but when they become so mushroomy that they start to look, they become almost corked and unpleasant. And, I mean, the fruit will go. That's a natural progression. The fruit drops out. The bead becomes smaller / towards flat. You'll get more richness, more golden colours if it's a Chardonnay, particularly when it's Chardonnay-based. But those flavours really change.
Yeah.
Coming way back round to where we were.
Yeah.
Exactly. What was that question? On a wine list, I mean, I'd be going for, you don't need to spend hundreds and hundreds unless it's, I have a penchant for Salon.
And Salon, champagne Salon.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. My first memory, I think, I don't know if I said last time, my very first memory when I tried wine, I went, hold on a moment, I get this vintage difference. But I was on a wine trip with Bibendo, as it happens. Long, long time ago. And we were staying in Reims and we went to a great little brasserie and you could take away. the wines. But we had Verve was their house, and they had Krug 88 and Salon 88.
Mm. Jolie, nice.
And it was really interesting. So we started with the Krug, because that's what we thought. And we remember tasting it and then timing how long it stayed, had the persistence on the palate. Mm. Nice. Then we went to the Verve. Actually, I don't remember the order now, but we had the Verve. We went, okay, you can see the difference was marked. And then we had Salon. And I will never forget, the persistence was 15 minutes. I remember saying to the others, they're going, bloody hell, I can still taste this now. Mm-hmm. It's, like, it's still there. And I'd heard about Salon. And coming from Oz, it was not well known. There's very little. But at that time, it was also incredibly good value. It was really cheap. This is in the days of Franks. And they were under £100 a bottle.
Mm. Which is a very good value. Just in case if you don't know this brand, now it's a bottle of Salon. We are more close to the 1,000 than the 100.
And it's a special wine. It's a Blanc de Blanc. They're only making the only the best years.
You didn't make that much since 2000, actually. I think.
I don't know what their volumes were, but it's small, and it's a wine that it's a special wine. But and I was very privileged. A couple of years ago, I tried. I think I had 07, and I had a 97.
Whoa!
And I mean, they age well.
Yeah.
They really do.
Yeah, apparently they're made to age well. Yeah. That's why they select like the very precise on the which year they're going to make the champagne.
Everything else is declassified and goes to another, under another mark.
De la Motte?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So De la Motte is always great because, you know, if it's declassified Salon fruit a lot of the time. But yes, I love Salon. plug.
Well, for the next birthday of Victoria, if you don't know what to...
Exactly.
When we ask you to come back for an episode number 2,
yes,
it's also at the moment where I saw a few reels on Instagram when you were talking about something which I thought was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the fact that when you order in a restaurant, you order some wine, a bottle of wine, and the waiter or the sommelier is going to try the bottle before sending it to you. So I thought it would be like a very interesting conversation because I know there's some very... not old school, but conventional people saying you need to do that to make sure the bottle is not cork, everything is okay, so you can give the best service. And there's the other part saying that you're drinking the wine I'm paying. The bottle is probably like less than £100, so there's absolutely no need to try the bottle. What's your think?
I started a bit of a discussion on this, and another group I'm on, they were like, part of it is, I always preface this by saying, as an Australian, we have more laid-back approach. But I also think it's a pragmatic approach.
Mm.
Particularly now, post-Brexit, post-COVID. So I think, you know, my answer 20 years ago, when I was 2, would be very different to where it is now. And I think there's, particularly when staffing is difficult, knowledge is a lot less than it has been. Because people are coming into the industry, sort of they've been inspired, but they're still learning and they don't have the palate or the knowledge to gauge sometimes. I think, and also, if you've got one sommelier in a restaurant and that one person has to open every bottle for every guest, for every table, that's going to slow everything down. You want your wine then and there.
Of course.
So that's one part. There's a lot to unpack in this question.
Yeah, no, it is. That's why it's a very large subject. And to be fair, we feel like we've continued that it was very interesting to talk about this because it's kind of a mix of like the old school rules. And now we're in 2024, things have changed.
Yeah.
Do we still need to continue this? I know there's some restaurants that stopped completely. There's some restaurants that still do it, mostly Michelin restaurants.
Look, I think... for me, the role of a sommelier is to create a wine list which is relevant to the food that is being served. It's not just about a sommelier's wet dream of what they want to have or looking after their mates. And I see it time and time again and it annoys the crap out of me because you're, there's that wine. Yeah, that's their mates. Oh, that's their... if it's a good wine and it works with the food, great. But I see so many places where a new son will come in and suddenly he's like, I'm going to get rid of all of this stuff and I'm going to replace it with all my friends' things and this and this. And it is, and it's not just in London, it is international.
Worldwide.
It's worldwide. I've seen it, I've seen it in Melbourne and then you see one wine list that seems to repeat across many restaurants. So for me, the skill of a sommelier is to understand the food, the objective of what the restaurant wants to achieve, staffing, and is it more formal or is it informal? Either way, a sommelier, when people say to me, oh, they need to make sure that the wine's in good condition. If it's not being served at the table in good condition, they're not doing their job correctly.
Yeah.
Those wines should not be warm. If they're too warm, they should already be in the right place. Where I see it is that, and yes, nothing gets my goat more, is that when someone shows me the bottle, then they bugger off and taste it. And then they share it with a colleague, not because they're not sure if it's right or not, because they're tasting it, is to try that wine. And even as recently as last night, I saw the same thing happen at another venue. I'm like, guys, come on. If it's under £100, if you're going to put a nominal price on it,
yeah.
Even unless it is a wine that is particularly rare, that might have, it might look a bit dubious when it's being opened, that's when you taste the wine.
Yeah,
you want, that's when you're checking.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm at a table showing a guest a wine and I'm opening it and I'm like, hang on, this doesn't look right. And I will say to them, I'm not sure, the cork looks a bit strange, this isn't working as I'd expected. I'm just going to check it first for you. If you're happy, I'll taste it in front of them, because there is nothing worse than going off away from the table. You can't see what they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's very traditional, and you see that in a lot of more traditional restaurants, and many people will understand what's being done. But I think in this day and age where we're far more casual, there's a lot more people eating out than previously,
yeah,
despite current economic conditions, it has to be explained to the guest. I'm going to check this wine because blah, blah, blah. And that means I need to go and taste it, but I will taste it in front of you first. But for me, it's like, no, you, if the wine looks dubious, suspect, something not right, you check it there and then and say, I'm not happy with that. Mm. I mean, there have been plenty of times where I've done that and I've gone, I'll pour a bit and go, this isn't looking right. I'll just check it first. Right. So I can do this, but I'm going to get another bottle. That's where the skill is. That's what my skill set is, that you're looking after the guest. It's not about double-checking the wine to make sure it's okay. It should be okay if it's been cellared properly. Mm. If it's been stuck downstairs or upstairs in something way too warm, you're going to be nervous and probably checking everything. And that's me being slightly cynical. But I think there's a place now. Yes, the guest wants to have the great experience. All they want is to get the wine in front of them on time with their food or before their food, frankly.
Yeah.
And also, normally when you order a bottle of wine, the waiter or the sommelier is going to pour a little bit of wine in your glass and ask you to try. So if you try before and then you try, what's the point? Because the customers were supposed to try and see if everything is well with the wine. It's not to say if you like the wine or not.
Yeah, 101, it's not to see if you like the wine. And I think a lot of people, that's been lost in translation. Go, no, I don't like this. No, it's to check if it's faulty. Mm. Now, I think I may have said when my judging days with the Wine Challenge, there was at least 6 years where we were, and we still maintain, any fault we catalogue. And I actually went back to Australia for their fault, what's it called? They built a database and did an assessment and research on wine faults and what they were. These days, cork is much better. It's less contaminated. We see fewer cork taint. We'd see more other faults through screw caps than we would in cork, under cork. But so my point is that there are plenty of faults out there.
Yep.
But it's changed so much. And I think, as I said before, my 101 is that if you're dining out and you've ordered a bottle of wine, you don't want to wait for someone to go and get the bottle, taste it, share it with a colleague. Doesn't matter how little it is. You want your wine when you want it and not to delay. So that's on that service approach.
Yeah.
But when you have people taking the piss.
That's true. And there's also a thing is like, I remember when I used to work in a restaurant, we used to do this, presenting the bottle to the guest, coming back to the station, tasting, opening the wine, tasting the wine, and going back to the table. And I did enjoy it. I was just tasting just to taste if the wine was not faulty. But I did enjoy it because I had the privilege and the chance to try so much wine and good wine. So I was happy about it.
Of course.
But also I can, from like a customer perspective, I can understand that it's a bit frustrating sometimes if it's not a very expensive bottle.
I think, yeah, and that's where I was going, getting slightly sidetracked, is that if you're going to present it to the guest, you take it off and taste it, and it's fine. The guest doesn't need to taste it. You're then saying, it's absolutely fine. You're the arbiter of taste. It's fine. And you pour it.
Exactly.
That's what should be done.
Yeah.
If the guest is still tasting it, and most people expect to taste it, and there is still that thing of, oh, there's cork floating in it. That is not cork taint. That just happens to have some cork floating in it. And without sounding like a bit of a twat.
I was expecting a word like that.
I was trying to think of another word, but that's what came to me. You know, there are certain things that people don't understand about wine.
Mm.
And you don't need to be an ass about it. You just say, oh, no, that doesn't mean it's corked. It just has some cork floating in it. And again, that's where, if you've got a sommelier or wine waiter, that's what we are there to do, to help educate and train and teach people what they're trying.
There's one thing, sorry to interrupt, but because you said cork. When you serve a wine to someone, you get the people who says, yeah, it's fine, I'll drink it straight away, because either they don't know what they're drinking,
or they don't,
all that. You've got the person who's going to smell it, drink it, taste it, and say, yeah, it's fine. And then you've got the person that's just going to give one smell and be like, yeah, that's fine. Out of the, obviously, the last two, which one is more of a professional in the sense of, because I feel like just by smelling it, you know if it's corked or not.
You're going to know if it's corked.
Do you already?
No, you don't. Because you can smell a wine. We're just going to, this entire podcast is going to be about.
Yeah.
that's education, though.
Presenting and tasting
wine. Great. Yeah.
Because I think it is. I mean, there are many times that I've smelt a wine and gone, yeah, that seems fine. And then you give it a bit more air.
Bim.
And it's not right at all. The issue you have is if you've poured that whole bottle out, it becomes a little bit awkward to say, excuse me, this wine is not how it should be. That happens rarely.
Mm.
But I think for me, I will always smell and taste if I'm the guest. Working as a sommelier, if I'm checking a wine, I will always smell it. I never smell the cork. I smell the bottle. Or if I'm checking something, rarely, and I've seen other somms do the same, or sommeliers do the same, that they'll smell it, they're not going to drink it, they leave it and go, happy with that.
Yep.
And often they will actually put it back in the bottle.
Mm.
Now, post-COVID, maybe we don't do that anymore, and maybe people get a bit more sensitive. But it is what it is. But it's finding that balance that the guest understands what's going on.
Mm.
I think the key for all of that is communicating to the guest. But I think it is really cheeky when you see someone. It becomes, and I've worked with sommeliers who've gone, oh, but if I can't taste the wine, I don't want this job.
Yeah.
No, the role of a sommelier is not to taste every bottle and build their knowledge. You do that during tastings and with training, and you learn that way, and you attend courses, and you go to, we're in London. So speaking in London, and I may have said last time, there's nearly a tasting every day.
Every day. Events, tasting,
and there's multiple, and there is no reason not to build a database, a library of wine knowledge and wine notes. Because don't go to a tasting and don't take notes, because that's bullshit. Because you taste, you get pissed.
Yeah.
And there we go. Get on my little soapbox.
Go for it.
If there is one thing that is such bad manners, if you're invited to a tasting, you take notes.
Yeah.
One, it helps you remember. It helps you focus. Because more often than not, you're tasting and you're chatting to someone. I mean, you might be asking if the winemaker's there or the importer. You can ask some questions. Mm. But you ought to have some information.
Yep.
And maybe you call me old school. Record it. I don't care. But at least you've got a library of information. Because otherwise...
What's the point?
What's the point? You're just getting pissed. Yeah. Sorry, you're just enjoying some wine at someone else's cost. Yeah. And I just, there's a time and a place, and it's a wine trade.
It's a bit of a disrespect, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is. And also there's a thing, is like, as a sommelier, so you're always working with suppliers who supply your wine, etc. I feel like for me, like this meeting with suppliers, which when you work as a supplier, sometimes it's very difficult to get a meeting and a tasting with restaurants. But that's the moment when you can try a lot of wine. I mean, the suppliers is here to opening bottle for you and to give you a lot to try. Mm. And most of the time, the supplier is going to be more than happy to bring more bottle than you ask because he wants to sell the wine, yeah. Which makes sense. But that's a good opportunity, for example, to try the wine. And on this point, most of the restaurant and sommelier, they tend to always be busy, doesn't have time. Obviously, I get it. They're very busy. But that's also like the opportunity to try a lot of wine.
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure it's during the service.
Look, having been an importer and, you know, pounded the pavement from ground zero with no contacts, literally door knocking, two things you have to do. One is know your customer. Mm. There is nothing worse than someone coming in saying, so tell me about your restaurant. Look at the wine list first. People come in and say, can I just drop this portfolio off? Oh, here's a sample. I'm like, who are you? Do you know what we do?
Hello.
Do you see that we are, we are a French-only restaurant and you're bringing me Portuguese wine. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
You know, it's really simple. Do your homework first.
Yeah. Especially the ones that come during lunchtime or...
You know. 5 o'clock 6 on a PM. Friday. 1 o'clock, any lunchtime.
Yeah.
And there are certain, 101 rules. But you also need to understand who's doing the buying, what their motive is, what their palate is like, and how many friends they already have that they're...
It's so difficult now. There's so much importer. As you said, like sommelier, they only work with their friend. I'm not even going to talk about the big brand who offer like X amount of cash back when you order a free palette of X brand. And also now with the fact of like, are you natural wine? Are you doing fine wine? Do you specialize in Italian wine? Because there's so much importer, they specialize in a country or in a style or in prices. I mean, fine wine or cheap wine.
It's really hard. And having done it on both in Australia and the UK, to understand, and for me, the UK market is more open-minded than the Australian market.
Do you mean in terms of what?
In terms of me walking through the door and seeing people. Sorry, anyone listening. But, I mean, when I was, this champagne. So when I brought this to Australia, it had not hit the UK shores. I found here at a tasting, they were looking for distribution in the UK. I saw it and went, this is amazing. Took it to Australia. It landed. About a week later, they said, Victoria, we have good news. It has 3 stars in the Guide Hachette. I'm like, what's a Guide Hachette? I had no idea. But I just knew it was bloody good wine.
Mm.
And I took this to different buyers over there. And they're like, I'll just have to do some research into it. And I found it really interesting. And I don't know if it's changed, but rather than them saying, no, thank you, or I need, they want to check with their mates if people are buying it. So it's really, I was bringing, what I specialised in there was bringing in existing wines to a brand new market that had never seen these wines. So unless you've got a marketing budget behind you to help promote, you're going to, and that's where owner operators are really great to work with because you develop that relationship.
Of course. Yeah.
And it's like, I like what you're doing. I see what you're doing. You're brave. The wines are really good. We can sell them. Mm. There's nothing that made my blood boil more when people said, I just don't know where to put it on the wine list.
There's always place on the wine list for a wine.
Always.
I hate when people, they say, I don't have place on my wine list. Do you have like 2,000 selection of wine in your wine
list? But also,
why
are you seeing me? Why are you coming to a tasting?
Yeah.
Are you just... window shopping. One is great. You want to learn and you want to develop your knowledge. I get that. But if if people are coming to see you, one, as you said, to get time with the wine buyer, whatever business they're with, is tough. One is, I think, several things. Now these days, there's so much demand on their time. There's so much admin. But also there's a reticence. People just don't want to be bothered, or they want to come and see you when they need something. People buy in different ways. It's as if you're looking to sell wine into any restaurant, independent merchant, you need to understand how those people buy.
Mm, of course.
Because some people will just be changing their list all the time. Others will say, this is my list for this season or for the next 6 months or for the next 12 months.
Fair.
And if you know, and you, great.
Yeah.
But it's super complicated and it's bloody hard. Mm. And you can't, and I'm the most cynical. Because I'm like, what have you brought me? Do you actually understand what I'm looking for? No, you don't. Out. In a nice way. You don't want to waste people's time and, you know, don't open that bottle for me. And that's where Coravin is great.
Yeah.
And that is one of the saving graces, because when you've got higher end wines, you can lose and waste so much wine. But it's all about being targeted. So if you know what your potential customer wants, you can go, oh, okay, so they like these sort of wines. Mm. But, you know, when I had my business, I was eating at those restaurants. I was dining, I was drinking before I'd even make an appointment. So I would make sure I'd go to everything first before I'd ever go. And so then when I showed them wine, I'd have a 90% hit rate. I'd show them six wines, I'd list five. Sometimes I'd list them all. It's an investment, but it rewards you.
It's actually probably the best way to create a relationship with the sommelier, because you're not having the position of the salesman, woman, but you're in the position of the guest. Yeah. So they have to listen to you and they have to make time for you, because it's
and job. Then if you're engaged with them, there's more chance that you say, oh, you're interested in wine. Oh, you're doing this. Okay, and you've drunk those wines. That's interesting. I'll have a look. I can find space. Even if you're just doing it for a month to trial something.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't hurt. It's so easy to say no. It's always easier to say no than yes, I think.
Yeah.
As in for appointments. When you get to the wine and say, oh, maybe... Everyone's a bit too polite, and it's better off just to save everyone the...
Of course. It's a waste of time for the sommelier, for the sales rep, lost of money for the sales rep company.
Is that an English obligation thing, though?
Sorry?
Is that an English obligation? Like, oh, I want to be too really polite.
It is.
Be polite. Don't want to say no. Sure. Yes, please. Oh, absolutely. And you're sitting there going, I hate all of these wines.
It is.
Oh, thanks so much. That was really interesting.
It is.
Do you have the same in food as well? Or?
Yeah. Oh, all the time. Yeah. All the time. Say a big smile, but then once it's not face to face.
Just be honest.
Thank you very much, guys, for listening. Don't forget, it's just the end of the part one, and the part two with Victoria will be released next week.
Yeah, we decided to cut it in two because we went a bit long. We could have gone longer, but we decided to stop.
So it's not too long for you to listen.
Exactly. So, yeah, thank you very much, guys, for listening.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye. The Hospitality Podcast.